The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this morning, I'm mostly interested in responding to any questions or comments that some of you might have.
Yes, so we all know what it feels like to connect with another person. You can feel it, you know that there's some kind of energy through the ether, and it's elusive. You can't make it happen, and it goes away, and it comes. How do Buddhists think about this? The feeling of being connected to a person.
I don't know how Buddhists think about it. but I think that...
Or how Gil thinks about it.
What I found for myself is that in the course of my Buddhist practice, that the barriers between myself and others, certain kinds of barriers, tend to fall away. The ideations, the self-image concerns, the ideas, the busyness of my mind tend to fall away. And there was kind of a softening in my heart area, I guess. So in the course of that, with less barriers and more sensitivity, I certainly felt a lot more connected to other people. And it became a very important part of my life. I think that one of the great motivating factors for a spiritual life is compassion. And compassion has to do with that connectedness. And so as I kept practicing, I felt more and more connected, and it became an important principle for this life of mine. And at the same time, the path to that connectivity was, in a sense, was not clinging to things. So it's very important not to cling to that connectivity. And there's a lot of clinging that people have in relationship to other people, or in all the different domain, all the different things that come up into play. And a very important part of my own Buddhist practice also, not only was this opening and connectivity that I came to feel very strongly, but also was to really see clearly all the attachments I had around the relational world, and all the wanting to be connected or not wanting to be connected, or all the ideas I had about what it meant. And as I've often said, one of the big lessons I had to learn was to overcome a particular neurosis of wanting everyone to like me. I mean, it's a nice idea, but to be attached to that is a hopeless task. Hopeless task. How's that as an answer?
Yes, good. I felt connected to you.
Great. So I saw a hand over here. Okay, go ahead.
Oh. Well, I had about five questions that came up as he was talking, and I can only pick one. I'll pick the first one that came to mind, which is, how do you respond to things like the earth, the latest hurricane? Like, how do you stay out of sort of the suffering of it because you're helpless? And, me as a person, people in Florida, and I can't do anything about it. I could send money. I can do things. But it's not really going to change the impact of that hurricane. So I'm just curious how you respond when you hear that devastating news.
Well, my heart gets broken a lot. So it's certainly heartbreaking, some of the things I hear, and just the stories of it, and some of these islands that have been devastated in the Caribbean. It's heartbreaking, and the people have been hurt and died, and whole towns, whole islands devastated. It's heartbreaking. And so I feel it's important to be a witness for that to some degree. So, I'm not very motivated generally to stay on top of the news. So I have to motivate myself a little bit to do so. And so a part of the motivation is this feeling of needing to be a witness for what goes on in the world. And in a sense also that, this interconnected thing. One of the remarkable things in my kind of role, I meet a lot of people, is how many times I've read something in the news and then I meet someone who was affected by that news. And it seems like it's happened a lot. So now when I read the news, I kind of also read it because, you know, I probably get to meet someone. I probably know someone who's somehow impacted by it. And so I want to be somewhat informed. So I try to stay informed. It's important to be a witness. And it's important for us all to kind of feel, or I feel it's important to be sensitive, aware of what's going on, not to turn away from it. But, you know, it's also not just suffering that goes on. And these kinds of events, in some ways, the more challenging they are for people, the more there are tremendous stories of people pulling out of them great acts of compassion, great acts of generosity, great acts of sacrifice that are deeply inspiring. And it's very inspiring to me to have a sense of that and see that and know that what people are capable of doing. And if it's, you know, in some ways we see the beauty of human hearts more clearly in situations like that than we do sometimes if, you know, we just go around, you know, without any kind of real challenge around us. So I think it's also important to be a witness for that and to see that and know that that's also there. Because the question is, what do we want to support in our society? And if we're only supporting being horrified and being frightened and being oppressed, I don't think that's really so healthy for the rest of us. But if we can also be, if the goodness in our heart can be inspired and we're inspired to live that way and act our way that way ourselves, and that makes a huge difference. So on one hand, to have our heart broken, and the other hand, to have our hearts healed at the same time by what we read, what we encounter, what we do, is important. And the last thing I'll say, in terms of you asked, you know, is about how to respond. And so then there's also the question of what kind of active response do I make when something is far away? Do I now get organized to make donations to the Red Cross or different organizations in Houston? You know, anyway, there's the organizations that, you know, if you do a little bit of research, you'll find out there are organizations I'm connected to because I know the people involved, so that, you know, there's places to donate where, you know, 100% goes to the relief. And, you know, or other ways of responding. And then it takes some wisdom to know what to respond, because the instinct to, you know, to be helpful sometimes comes more from trying to avoid our discomfort rather than really being helpful. And sometimes people are instinctually helpful too quickly. And I've heard stories of people donating clothes, for example, close to Haiti, and a tremendous amount of clothes end up in the runways in the airport of Haiti they couldn't use. And then it started raining, and they just had to come and take it all to the dump because it was no use for them. It was actually more useful for them. Also, I've heard of people getting shipped, you know, truckloads of water, you know, boatloads of water, because it turns out that they would have been much more effective to have been donated the money rather than the water, the money they bought the water with, because then they could build wells or water purifiers, and that lasts for a long time. So the idea of instinctually responding with what seems like a, you know, feel-good kind of thing is, you know, it's nice. It's also inspiring to know there's good, that kind of generosity, but I think that having some wisdom, some being informed well what's going on, and is an important part of this. And knowing what the best outcome is. And one more thing I'll say for myself is, you know, there's so many heartbreaking things all over the world. And I think I feel it's important. I'm quite to be impacted by that. But the impact means to be willing to be changed by it. And if we're not willing to be changed by the tragedies around us, I don't think we do, I want to say justice, but I think it's actually kind of harmful if we aren't willing to be changed. And so how do we want to be changed? And one of the ways is to be motivated to make a difference in the world, but it doesn't have to be for that event. And I have other things, I have particular things that I, you know, my schedule is pretty full. And so I do a lot. And so rather than kind of picking up something new to be involved in and focus on, It generates motivation to try to do better what I do here, or what things I do, try to do better, try to give more time to it, or whatever. So it's indirect to the world rather than to that particular thing. And when that's the wise thing to do, and when, you know, there's so many questions. But I hope that these things, we're willing to be changed by our world. And that's part of this connectivity that Barry asked about. I don't think we can be really connected in some heartfelt way to others without being willing to be changed by others or be influenced and impacted. So maybe move the mic down here.
So yesterday you introduced the five faculties or the capabilities we have to improve our practice. So there was confidence, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And you introduced them as two pairs. Mindfulness stands on its own, but energy and concentration, they need to be balanced. They can go out of whack. I was surprised that loving kindness or compassion doesn't come into these. And because I'm slowly beginning to find that when you have compassion and loving kindness, it helps with concentration in the practice. So how does this not fit into or the faculties? The loving kindness doesn't seem to fit in there.
Yeah. So there are these five capacities, faculties that human beings have that is emphasized in Buddhism, and they can be applied to any activity we do, and not apply, but they're present to some degree in any activity we do. And these five are some degree of confidence, some degree of energy or effort, some degree of mindfulness, attention, some degree of concentration or focus on what we're doing, and some degree of wisdom or discernment, being discerning about what's going on, so we can do it well and appropriately. And if you're going to make a cake, those five are going to be present. Hopefully you have a little bit of confidence that you can make the cake. You have the right recipe. You've done it before. I thought about this morning. I make waffles for my son every Sunday morning. I've been doing it for years. So I was just remembering, you know, when I first started making waffles for my kids, I pulled out the recipe. And who needs a recipe now? I just pour in some flour, some sugar, you know. I kind of know what it takes, you know. So I have confidence I can do it without, you know, the recipe. So I have confidence, and I don't just sit on the dining room table, kind of looking at the counter, and you know, yes, I have confidence, and it'll happen. I have to do something. There has to be some effort involved. And then it does take mindfulness, attention in what I'm doing, because I need to, I have to have some sense of how much of each of the ingredients to do, and so I have to watch and pay attention and allow me this inner automatic calculation to happen because I'm paying attention. And then, especially when I'm stirring out the lumps, I need concentration. You know, some real focus, steady there, and be present. And then I have to have this discernment. I have to see how many lumps there are. I have to see, you know, how thin or thick the batter is, and you know, a variety of things. And that has to operate. So anything we do at all, these five faculties are involved. So they're actually universally applicable in all situations. Loving kindness maybe is universally applicable in all situations, but maybe not. Maybe there are times when loving kindness is not quite the right thing. Maybe compassion is, or equanimity is, or something else might be. So looking at the five faculties, they're always present. When they're applied to meditation practice, loving kindness sometimes is, and compassion are very important practices, and they are concentrating. But there comes a time when, things like loving kindness and compassion are extra and are too much for meditation practice. In fact, my teacher in Burma, who was a champion of compassion, when we were practicing, he said, don't be involved in compassion right now. You know, don't have any thoughts about it, because that's just going to make your mind more busy than the deep concentration that he wanted us to have. In teaching by the five faculties, we're teaching about something that was universally applicable in all situations. Loving kindness and compassion is a little more specific. And then nicely, the five faculties apply to the practice of loving kindness. You can have confidence in it. You can put effort into it. You can have mindfulness as you do it. You can get focused and concentrated as you do it. And you should have a lot of wisdom if you're going to be in the world of loving kindness, especially if you're going to do it in the world. Does that answer your question? Yeah? Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks. Can you explain the couple of sentences with regards to karma and Buddhism? I'm very bothered by, is it Burma or Myanmar? I don't know what it's called, the country. But this ethnic cleansing that sort of goes on. I'm surprised that in a culture which is largely Buddhism would allow this. And so what have the Muslims done to have this karmic actions?
Oh, I don't know.
Sorry, I know it's like
karma,
confusing.
Karmic actions. I think that, as I understand the teachings of karma as taught by the Buddha, it's not used to understand why something has happened, but rather it focuses on what we're doing now and how that's going to have consequences in the future. Because if we look in the whole thing, what's the karma for why this is happening now? We can't really know. And also it lends itself, especially when there's broad generalizations, like for whole people, it actually comes kind of dangerous can be a form of prejudice, it can be a form of putting people into some kind of stereotypes and all kinds of things. And it also can be too easy to fit along with some people's political agendas to assign karmic blame or something on people. So what's going on in Burma? I'm not so well informed, but it's pretty bad. But what I can tell you is that Buddhism is not immune to the kind of religious nationalism, religious fascism, religious fundamentalism that exists in all, seemingly in all religions, especially if all in religions where they are big enough to kind of have a kind of a national identity. And we've had it. You can name the different religions, and see pretty powerful news where there's people killing and fighting in the name of religion. And so we've had that. This exists in Buddhism down through the ages. And I can, you can point to different places and different times and different countries where that's happened. So there has been a reputation that Buddhism has gotten in the West for a while, for some decades, that no wars were fought in the name of Buddhism, which is supposed to make Buddhism special. And it's dangerous to be special. It's a kind of conceit that Buddhism is better than other religions. Look, we don't do wars or something. So not that it's terrible what's happening in Burma, but for kind of some of these, for Buddhists who have this conceit that Buddhism is the best or something like this, and we don't have these things, it's actually maybe helpful to kind of knock us down a little bit. And kind of be a little more humble about our Buddhism and be a little bit more, not blind to that human nature plays itself out in all religions, and human nature can be pretty bad. And so there are, hopefully a small minority in Burma of even Buddhist monks who are advocating fighting and killing, kind of terrorist types. And so I think it's very important for Buddhists to be opposed to that and stand out that this is not the Buddhism that we believe in or adhere to, and it doesn't have any role in Buddhism. And I think that's relatively easy to argue because of the tremendous emphasis that the Buddha gave on nonviolence and not killing. And that was the number one precept in Buddhism is not to kill. And I think that, some of us take that pretty seriously, that this is an important precept. And And one of the fundamental principles of Buddhism, not only not to kill, but even more fundamental, is not to harm. There's an ancient teaching that the characteristic, that the Dharma is characterized by non-harming. So people who argue differently, I feel like this, we can't condone that or support that as being Buddhist. So when we see these kinds of terrorist and Buddhist attitudes, but to what degree is what's going on in all over the world where there are different ethnic groups fighting each other? Is it really a religious conflict, or is it some other kind of conflict that's playing itself out with religious justification? What is it, one way or the other? But my heart goes out to the Muslims in Burma, and I've thought about how, there are some of my friends who are actually involved much more in what goes on in Burma have been involved in trying to support them and help them and do things for them, and I wondered about our responsibility or our ability to respond by supporting them and it's whatever the Muslims in Burma, you're asking what's their karma for what's happening to them. I'm more interested in asking what's the karma of the people who are destroying their lives. The Burmese Buddhists who are killing them and burning their villages and pushing them out, that's the karma that I'm concerned about, because that affects all of us. So those are my thoughts. Do you want to ask more, or is that...
Well, I guess my point is, so if they, let's say you go to Bangladesh or you go to Pakistan or whatever, is the karma going to be then the actions of other communities like the Western, folks? Is it sort of the actions now that will take place to sort of support and help? Because you're saying the karma is now what the actions will be now, right?
I'm very shy to spend too much time talking about the word karma. Is very, it's rife with challenges and difficulties to use the word karma, exactly what it means. But I think that we can look at consequences and a cause and effect relationships of things. And so what's going to be the consequences of these people ending up refugees in Bangladesh, which is a poor country, has its own challenges. And we know that refugees have a hard time. And refugees who live in poverty sometimes end up, doing things in the world that, continue the harm. And so if there's some way of supporting these refugees so they can have a better life, or some way of getting to go home, then helping them go home to Burma so they can, get reestablished, I think it creates better circumstances for everyone. So here's I've told this story before, but it's, I want to say it today, because it so inspires me, and I wanted to write an article about this month, but I didn't get around to it. So I'm inspired by what happened in San Francisco in 1952, and it has to do with this very famous little poem, a verse by the Buddha, that says, hatred is never overcome by hatred. By love alone is hatred overcome. This is the ancient truth. And that was spoken in San Francisco in 1952 at what was called the San Francisco Peace Treaty, or Peace Conference. And after World War II, after the Japanese were defeated in the war, Japan was basically conquered, and it was being ruled by mostly America. And the question is, what was supposed to happen to Japan after the war? And there were different opinions by different countries who had been affected by Japan, that Japan had invaded and destroyed. And some countries were afraid of Japan and never wanted Japan to be an autonomous country again. There was a desire to break Japan up into, and have different, Germany was broken up into two states. And there's a variety of different things people wanted. Some people wanted a lot of restitution. They wanted a lot of money paid for all the damage that had been done. So it was a big conference. So something like 40-some countries from around the world were invited to this conference. And there was they apparently weren't coming to an agreement what to do about Japan. And Japan, 1952, 51, was still quite poor and, you know, still devastated by the war. And so the foreign minister from Sri Lanka spoke up and gave a speech. In the speech, he said, Sri Lanka was never invaded by Japan, but we were bombed, and a lot of things were destroyed. But we see Japan as part of our family here in Asia. And we want the Japanese to, we don't want them to leave them in poverty and leave them subjects of other people. We want them to have the dignity and value of, you know, and be able to reconstruct their society. And so we don't want any restitution from them. We don't want anything, any compensation at all. And rather, we want to support them to become an independent country again. And then he said, then he recited this verse at this conference in San Francisco. Hate is never overcome by hate. By love alone is hate overcome. This is the ancient law. And the account of this conference of all these dignitaries, all these politicians who came to discuss it, when he recited that verse and gave his speech, everyone relaxed. And then they decided to give Japan its independence, an independent country. And the kind of support that Japan got after World War II, it's remarkable to have someone that was involved in such dramatic war and do so much evil to end up being supported to become, you know, kind of a friend of the world in many ways and a peaceful country. So I think that this kind of attitude is very inspiring. And so how can we look to do that elsewhere and support people rather than push them aside or ignore them or say they don't deserve to be helped? This morning I read an account of this woman in California whose brother was murdered in the 1980s. And the murderer ended up in prison for life. And after many years, she went to visit the murderer. And then in the course of meeting him and getting to know him, they became friends. And she would go to the parole hearings and ask that he be released on parole. And it took many years, but eventually he was released, and, you know, she supported him, you know, getting established again. And that's a remarkable story, you know, that happens from time to time. They say, an article said that 1% of the California parole hearings, when the families of the victims come, they come to argue that the people should not be released. But 1% of the victims will come and argue for the person's release. So, you know, 1%, it'd be nice if it was 2% or more. So these are the kind of stories that inspire me and are meaningful, that hate is overcome by love, that we want to just find how to be supportive and helpful for people. And I think there's a tremendous amount of goodness in people's hearts. If the right conditions are there for support of it, that's what comes out. And there's also a capacity for tremendous evil in people's hearts. And if the conditions are such that people are under a lot of stress, a lot of challenges, that's what comes out. And Burma is a country that has been under tremendous stress for many years, and a lot of suffering and military regime and a lot of challenges and occupation by Japan and all kinds of things. So I don't know what kind of stresses the Burmese have been under all these years and how that plays out and what's happening now. But how can we support everyone? How can we, you know, point to something different? And perhaps for those of us who are Buddhists, it's maybe to remind people in Burma of some of these Buddhist teachings.
Agil, I wonder if you could say a few words about judgment. I find that sometimes I feel like I'm being very judgmental of other people, and I don't like that. And I'm looking at it now, and I'll give you a quick example. I have a friend. There's a couple who are friends of mine, and the husband, he just seems to be very lazy. He seems to take advantage of his wife, in my judgment. And So he seems lazy, he seems all these things, and it affects my relationship with him. And so.
There's a difference between discernment and judgment. And I think it's useful to see that difference. It's possible to discern, to see, to observe, that someone sits on the couch all day watching TV, and it's not helping as the spouse is going around and doing all this work, and they see the spouse is tired and blisters and cracked blood, and it's like it's just, calluses, and so it's possible to see that. And it's possible to be discerning about it and say, well, that's unfortunate, it's sad. And you can, in the discernment, say, let's look at more carefully and see, and maybe we see that it involves certain callousness on the part of the person watching TV all day. And it's possible to see that and be discerning and to recognize that really clearly. And part of the motivation then to be judgmental is sometimes because we're so uncomfortable with that. That we identify, we're caught by it, we're attached to something, to a view, to an idea, we're sometimes caught in our own discomfort of it, we don't like it, sometimes because we're caught in the idea of taking responsibility, I have to do something, I don't know what to do, and so the judgment is an easy way to assign blame, and it's kind of like an expression of taking responsibility for something. But I think it's important to appreciate and value our discernment, which is seeing something, maybe if we're seeing it seeing it accurately, and distinguishing that from getting angry, upset, discouraged, viewing it as bad, being hostile then to someone because of it. And if you can tease those two apart, then perhaps you can. It's easier to understand what's extra you're doing. Yes, you might be seeing accurately, but if you call someone lazy, that's probably not an accurate assessment in and of itself. That's a kind of second layer of judgment. So you want to kind of tease apart to what is actually being observed and what's actually going on. What are you discerning? What's wise about what you're seeing? And what is your discomfort with it? And how does your discomfort play out in ways which are not healthy for you? And probably not for them. So, and one of the things that's always useful, especially when a judgment like that person's lazy, is if they're good friends, is try to get under the surface and find out what's going on more deeply. Try to understand the person. Find out what's happening, and it might make a difference if you find out that maybe the person's not lazy. Maybe the person has some kind of medical issue. That this is the best, the heart is weak, and it's not going to admit that the heart is weak. But needs to take care of himself very well, and that's why the spouse is so generous. Or maybe the person's just a mean old guy, conceited mean old guy, and you'll learn more closely, how conceited the person is, but it's not enough just to know that. It's also useful to know the suffering that's underneath that. Because that person's suffering too if they're mean and conceited. And then once you kind of really know the person and understand more deeply, then you're in a better position to know whether this is the person you want to spend time with. Is this a situation you want to spend time with? Is this supportive of you? Is this making you a worse person? Is it too challenging, too stressful? And you have to kind of excuse yourself from that relationship. Or you have to kind of figure out a way to enter the relationship in a way that you're not triggered. Maybe you're more careful about the circumstances in which you do see them. Maybe you never see them in their home where you see that dynamic. Maybe you just meet them for lunch or walk in the park or something. So I don't know if these ideas help, but maybe it gives you something to think about. So you can move it back to your left.
You mentioned the neurosis of wanting everyone to like you. I have that too. But I'd love to know what you've learned through practice to address that.
So Yeah, so I became acutely aware of it in a circumstance where I was working in the monastery kitchen, and I was the kind of the manager of all these cooks who had to, and prep cooks who were, doing all this. And it was a situation with under pressure and cooking that, and I was kind of making sure things had to be done and get done in a certain time. In the monastery kitchen, the choreography was very exact. It was like down to the minute when lunch had to be served. And so there's a certain pressure and tension. And so and the monasteries are a little bit of a pressure cooker place as well. And the pressure cooker within the pressure cooker is the kitchen. And so the person who's running the kitchen is so there was a lot of pressure. And so I became acutely aware of how exhausting and difficult it was to do the social gymnastics to try to get everyone to like me in the kitchen. It was kind of impossible. And so I started to see the cost that it had on me. I started to see how exhausting and tiring and painful it was. And at some point I saw it was impossible to succeed. And that was the beginning to let up on it and relax around it. But it wasn't just letting go of it, relaxing, but I was also doing a lot of meditation. And the meditation gave me a feeling of well-being, of being settled, at home, connected, that didn't require any kind of support, praise, liking from other people. It was a kind of sense of well-being where I was certain kind of way I was a deep sense of well-being that welled up from inside, independent of my relationship to other people. So I saw the difficulties and the suffering I had around wanting to be alike. I saw the how exhausting and difficult it was, how debilitating it was for me. And so I learned to let go of it a little bit. But I also had a substitute or an alternative that was welling up inside of me. So it became a little bit like a snake that sheds its old skin. And so rather than, it wasn't like I was doing a frontal assault on wanting to be liked and trying to, analyze it and figure it all out and get rid of it and let go of it. It was more that I just kept growing spiritually. And at some point, the skin started to shed. And then it was easier to let go of it while it was shedding. So maybe I shed it a little bit faster than it would have otherwise. So those two things. Does that make sense? So it's very important, very useful to find something like meditation that feeds us and nourishes us, that gives us a different experience of being alive than some of our neurosis, some of our attachments and concerns. And classically, that's one of the functions of meditation, is to experience some sense of, some modicum of well-being that's independent of the conditions of the world, so it's easier than to shed things or not be caught by them. Or to realize there's more than one game in town. Some people, their only game they know is the relational game. Everything is negotiated and figured out in relationship to other people and who I'm connected to and who likes me and what they do, and just all about relationships. And part of what Buddhist spirituality can show is that, as important as that is, and the first question you have to do about connectivity, it's also there's another game, there's another resource, there's another place to be nourished by, and it's possible to be nourished by something which is not dependent on relationships. And that puts relationships in a different context. And as I said earlier, in some ways my sense of relationship, relatedness to people grew and developed through practice. At the same time, in a certain kind of way, it became, I don't want to say less important, maybe I don't want to say it that way, but in a certain kind of way, I had another refuge. I had another place of being inspired and being supported, being fed, that meant that I didn't have to be fed or I didn't have to get something from the relationships in order to feel good about myself. Is that... you want to say more or you want to respond? Or?
No, that's a lot.
That's a lot, yeah. Yes?
My 12-year-old daughter tends to spend a lot of time on her cell phone. And I've been trying to encourage her to do that less. Encourage would be a nice way to put it. She was giving me an example of how I might word it in a way that would be but easier for her to hear.
Oh, that's nice. I want to hear.
My tendency is to approach it each time with defeat. So with an impending defeat about the suggestion that she, in other words, the tone, that she's suggesting the tone doesn't help her feel inspired.
Sounds like you have a teacher at home.
So what she made me aware of is that every time I ask, I tell her how much time she has left to spend on her phone, that it is a disincentive to her to go along with it. And that she gave me a sort of an example of how it might look and sound when I asked her. That seems impossible to me, to be that hopeful and cheerful in my tone when I so often have had a different experience preceding it, right? So I'm wondering how this practice could help me in that moment when I'm trying to make something else happen that she could hear better.
Well, you know, this particular topic of teenagers at home and their cell phones, maybe I'm not qualified to answer. Because I have teenagers at home who have cell phones. And I don't know if I've succeeded in this domain. So, good luck. Or give up now. But you know, your question is, you know, you're independent of what to do about the teenagers and their phones and their devices. I think your daughter's. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't there. I don't know what she said, but I kind of love the fact that she gave you some feedback about the tone and what you're doing, and that maybe there is a different way of approaching it. And I'm constantly trying that at home. And I tried it the other day with my 14-year-old about his homework. And I don't know if I need to intervene with his homework, but, you know, he puts it off and puts it off. So I thought, well, I'm going to go in there and just have a simple conversation about his, you know, his homework for preparing for the test the next day, see if I can help a little bit and quiz him or something. So I came in, I was going to try to not be, have that tone of voice or something. And so I came in, you know, and careful, friendly, nice, no charge, no pushing, just kind of like open and, you know, whatever. And he said something like, no, I'm not, you know, you can't help me because you're too calm. So, can you ever get it right? But to answer your question more specifically, maybe to how you asked it, is I think it's important to do your own homework and to understand how you're triggered and how you're reactive and what you're afraid of and what's touching in you. And there might be all kinds of things which are don't need to be triggered inside of you. It's more says about you than your daughter. I'm not saying this is an example for you, but what I learned, with a little bit of surprise to me as I started having kids, was it turned out I had still some of the things I experienced as a kid were still kind of raw for me. And so I had a tendency of projecting out my kids and say, oh no, that's going to happen to them. And you know, I was just projecting on it, and those things didn't happen to them, but I was worried and concerned, oh, I have to be careful with that because, you know, it was a new world, different situation, but because I was still raw with my own suffering I had as a kid. So it was still there. I was surprised it was still there. And certain perspective, certain kind of way of seeing. And so I had to learn to see that part of myself as a parent and learn to understand I had to be careful with it and not project it onto my child and see that my child has their own life and it's very different than the life I grew up with. So anyway, so I would encourage you to do your homework. And hope your daughter does hers. So we should stop. If you think this can be quick, then we can...
Okay, this actually loops back to the previous question about the sermon. So one thing I often think about in a work environment is like, you know, how much peace I'm sacrificing in terms of dealing with situations. And I recall you mentioning that before. And so my question is, like, you were mentioning how it's more about the base meditative practice and how that gave you clarity into situation. But are there like situation-specific contemplations or reflections that may be applicable, or is that a futile domain and it's really more about getting back to the basics of practice?
So I'm not quite sure I understand. So in a work situation, mm-hmm. instead of getting back to the basics of practice, are there particular questions that are useful in the work environment to try to find your peace or to find a way to work through it?
Exactly, yeah.
Good question. I don't know. I don't have a good question. I haven't ever thought of it that way. But what comes to mind is to ask the question, what's the purpose of what you're doing? What's the purpose of, you know, the details? What's the purpose of the work you're doing? What's the purpose of the activity of the day, the activity of the hour? What's the purpose of the conversation you're having? What's really the purpose for your concern and what's happening here? And there's probably multiple answers to that question, not just one. And the more you can understand the purpose that's operating, that might clarify how to negotiate the circumstance you're in.
Thank you.
Okay. So, thank you all. Thank you for the questions. And it was nice to hear them. And I hope my responses were appropriate enough. And we do have the tea, and everyone's welcome to stay. And it's a nice time to hang out and go up and find people and say hello. And having community, being connected is valuable. So please enjoy each other. Thank you.